How much time are we going to use on this? So I can get some sense of how much leisure to...
We'll talk for about, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
See where it goes. We're not under a rigid time frame because I'm bouncing from one format to another, and you know, I realize my pace and my.
I heard a promo this morning that you were going to be on with Leonard Lopate. Is that his name?
Yeah, I just did that one. Yeah.
How'd that go?
I thought it was terrific. Yeah, he's very good. I mean,
he's very good. He does literary books.
Yeah.
So sometimes people just like you come from his broadcast.
Right.
Obviously tape it one.
Yeah, he's relaxed and he's easy, and that was good. It was fine, yeah. It was easy. Hume Cronin followed me. But, yeah, it wasn't bad. I mean, this is the third interview I've done today.
Today?
Yeah.
What was your first?
My first was Tom Vitale. Tom Vitale, NPR.
Oh,
right.
Oh, yeah.
And then I've got one more CBS satellite.
With Liz Gribben?
I think so, yeah. Then a reading tonight, and then I go to Philly in the morning, and I've got 3 weeks of this tour. I'm bouncing. It's a dog and pony act. I'm taking it on the road.
Well, that's great, though. You know how hard it is for fiction writers.
Exposure. Exactly. I mean, I'm not complaining. When you consider the alternatives, which is that I stay home and nobody buys the book.
Jane Byrne, as you probably recall, was the publicist on the book that I
Oh, that's right, with yours, yeah.
Yeah, that was 1988.
Yeah.
She managed to get me one radio interview with a station in Middlebury, Vermont.
Oh, yeah?
And I was scared to death. I thought the guy was... I mean, I can ask questions, but
yeah.
I wasn't sure I was going to be able to answer them.
Uh-huh.
The book was centered around H.L. Mencken, and I'm a Mencken buff, but not a scholar.
Right.
And if you ask me his birth date...
Yeah.
I couldn't remember. Uh-huh. I know the street he lived on, 1324 Hollins.
Yeah.
But a lot of the details, especially since the book had been out of my hands for a year or so,
sure.
I was afraid he was going to ask me to be a Mencken biographer.
Yeah.
And thank God he didn't. But I was scared. I mean, I don't know. You're so relaxed that you've done enough of these interviews.
Well, I hope so.
You have to worry about it. And right in the middle of the interview, the phone went dead.
Oh, yeah.
So he called right back. He put a commercial on and called me right back. So that was my one interview.
Oh, God. Well,
although the Ed McDowell of the New York Times did an interview with me, but that was not broadcast.
Yeah, yeah. The print interviews are easier in some ways, I think, because you can control what you say. You can say, no, I didn't mean that, scratch that, or whatever, and you can have some sense of control over it. And also, you don't have that time pressure. The TV, to me, is the worst. I really hate the TV stuff because they work in tiny segments of time. You can't say very much. The person's usually not read the book and doesn't really care about the book and is worried about, you know, what's coming next and is kind of engineering the whole thing. And it's tongue-tying, that kind of pressure, for me. And the radio is somewhere in between, and especially if they're taping it, I say, oh, okay, they're taping it, so, you know, we screw it up, they can cut it out.
Precisely.
Yeah, yeah. But the print interviews, I relax with those. I say, okay, good. Now I can go slow and think what I mean before I say it.
Well, let's talk about the Sweet Hereafter. Gosh, this was a beautiful book.
Oh,
I think I read it in two sittings. And that means that it's the kind of book that you really wanted to keep reading.
Oh,
you hated to say goodnight to yourself because it was so engrossing. Let's talk about that book and the locale. I understand you actually live in the Adirondacks, is that right? Or have a summer
house? It's more than a summer house now. I'm living there 6 months a year. 6 months a year in Princeton. I teach the spring term in Princeton. And then May to November, until the pipes freeze, I live up in the High Peaks area in the Adirondacks.
And what town is it? Are you near?
We're near about 15 miles from Lake Placid.
So, are you actually in a town or really out in
it's a town of 700 people, and we're about 3 miles out of town and at the end of a half-mile driveway.
RD delivery for an address?
Right, rural delivery, right.
So that is the setting for the
story. That kind of town. It's a fictional town located, a few miles outside of Lake Placid, and so its economy is shaped pretty much by summer tourism and ski industry just over the horizon, and passersby, and a little lumber and construction, and one thing or the other. It's a marginal town economically, but it's a tightly knit seriously integrated kind of town community. Where people know other people's children well, and their parents and grandparents, and who married whom and who divorced whom and who's having an affair with whom is pretty well known by the community at large, which is why it's for a novelist useful material, really, to work with. The novelist might take a hotel or a rooming house or a neighborhood block or a small town, because you get a number of characters who are intricately related, ready-made, for you. And so what happens to one has ramifications in the life of another, and so on. So that makes it useful, if you're really interested in telling a story about relations and connections to people and cause and effect and so forth.
So the town of Sam Dent is very similar to the village that you live near.
Yeah. I had a fun placing it. I even made a map of it, placing it between my town and the next town, which is called Jay. And I just essentially, sort of in my mind, turned the map, topographical map of that region, into rubber and stretched it out, and then dropped this town down between the two. So I could use a lot of local landmarks and mountains and rivers and roads and so forth and routes and keep them there. But this town exists between two existing real towns for me. At one point, when I was working on the book, the fictional town sort of bled into the real towns, and I would take a right-hand turn thinking that I was going to a landmark which was in the book, and the road would peter out into the woods or something, and the fictional town failed to appear. And I really literally got the two mixed up in my mind a lot as I worked.
Well, the big city lawyer who goes up to attempt to represent the families whose children were killed or injured in the bus crash, is quite impressed with the area. It's almost, I think he describes it, almost a wilderness.
And yeah, it is. It is still today. We're talking the center of the Adirondack Park, really, that 6 million acre reserve up there, and which is laced with these small towns throughout, from Glens Falls in the south to Monroe and Placid and so forth in the north. And it is still, a lot of it is wilderness. It's like the West. It's in the East. It's the nearest thing to Montana, Idaho, that part of the West,
I think. Well, I recall driving up to Montreal and taking the thruway.
Right.
When you reach high points on the thruway, you see miles and miles of rolling hills, mountains, stretching off endlessly and dark with green. And it looks like a wilderness, but I have a feeling it's all pretty well mapped and deep within the hollows and so forth. There are
It wasn't. It was mapped actually in the 1890s. It was mapped after the state of Washington was mapped, and after the northwest quarter of the country was already carefully mapped, and this part up there was still relatively unmapped and hadn't been surveyed. It is in the East, the last wilderness. Of course, for in the 19th century, it was a kind of a watering hole for New England and New York intellectuals and upper middle class, upper class vacationers who would go up there, because it was access to the wilderness. And when the wilderness was romanticized so in the late 19th century, this was the way you could get to see it, the grand vistas and the deer and the bear and so forth.
The last writer I recall living up there was Sloan Wilson. He lived in Fort Ticonderoga.
Oh, yeah? I didn't know that.
He's down in Florida now. Mm. How did you... you were...
Robert Louis Stevenson lived near there for a while. He briefly...
he's dead, though.
Stayed. He's dead, yeah.
But you were born in New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire. Raised in New Hampshire.
But how did you discover upstate New York?
I ended up there really through the good offices of my wife, who spent chunks of her childhood, summers and so forth, up there. Her family had been going up for several generations, and... And so about 5 years ago, we located a place that we wanted to use as a summer house, strictly. Then I was teaching full-time, she was teaching full-time, and we thought we'd just go there summers and work. And as prospects for teaching less appeared, the idea of staying there longer and longer seemed more attractive. So we've ended up now... every year we winterize another room in the house. I think eventually we may end up the year round. But I fell in love with the place. It has a kind of numinous quality for me that only really northern New England and maybe parts of the Caribbean have managed in my life. I mean, in the sense of where you walk through the landscape and everything seems significant, and which... it's for me a cue that my imagination is engaged. I can work here. I can imagine stories of great significance occurring here, at least significance to me. It has that quality, and it had it from the start. I think partially because it's the same latitude and approximate altitude which I was raised, so I have this kind of early childhood sensory response to the sound of the wind and the pine trees and the fall of the light and the fall... the sound of a brook or something like that. It smells right, you know, and it smells like the nest and that I came out of. And so, and yet it's for me a liberating place because I don't have the negative associations that you bring oftentimes out of your childhood, and which I certainly have which northern New England still bore for me. And I would have trouble going back to northern New England to live, I think, in a way that I have no trouble at all living here. I feel it's simultaneously a liberating and a new and yet an instantly and deeply familiar place to me.
Are your neighbors aware that they have a writer eavesdropping on them in their midst?
Well, I don't think of it so much as eavesdropping.
All writers eavesdrop.
Just paying attention is the way I think of it. I'm just noting and paying attention to them. They're very pleased, I think, by and large. They are, most of the people who live in that area are either have moved in from French Canada or across from Vermont and northern New England, that tier. The natives, that's their background in the last 100 years or so. The place was pretty much unpopulated until this century. They bring with them a kind of curiosity and interest and openness to strangers, I think. I feel very comfortable and have been nicely accepted in that town. And my wife and I have tried seriously to work in the town and to engage ourselves and with people. It's a nice place.
Well, if I read the suite hereafter correctly, I get the impression that it's at least as cold there as it is in northern Maine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a harsh climate. I mean, that is part of the reason I don't just leave there to come down south to teach because classes are starting. I leave there because the pipes are freezing and it's going to become a major operation to keep the driveway clear. And that's a serious objection. And but that, too, I guess, is one of the things I find instantly familiar and numinous in a way. I mean, this story starts in the dead of winter, as a number of other stories I've written have, but it ends 9 months later in the glow of autumn. So I've tried to use the seasons and the shift and mood, shift and move of the weather to follow the action of the story too.
Well, the premise of the suite hereafter is a school bus accident that kills 14 children injures others. Mm-hmm. And that the circumstances are seen through the eyes of, five?
Four characters. The opening narrator is the bus driver, a middle-aged woman, also ends the novel. She picks it up and has the fifth section.
Mm-hmm. How did this the thought of this book come to you?
Well, actually, I was in the middle of another book that I was just grinding out. At least it felt like that. It was like eating stones writing that thing. I just every day I'd grind my teeth against another mouthful of stones and hating it, willing myself to it. And I read an article that was following up on a catastrophe all too unhappily common these days, I suppose, not just these days, but a school bus accident in a small town in southern Texas, a Hispanic town community. And the article was a follow-up, and it portrayed the people of the town as having come to a terrible kind of circumstance following on the accident, with suits and countersuits and mistrust and anger, and the town had essentially come undone. The whole community, which was once had been a closely knit and interdependent social unit, had suddenly become dysfunctional, come undone. And I was fascinated by that. I thought, how can a community, a tribe, a family, if you want, even, or people, even a national entity, how can a people deal with catastrophe and not come undone? What do you do? What does a town do, or a family, or a people, when the sky falls in? Because it's going to fall in somewhere along the line. I believe that. Must we fly apart, from one another? So the novel is an attempt, among other things, I hope, to explore that question, and I hope answer it in a positive way, because I don't think that a community does have to fly apart. I think that there are ways to for a town or a community of any kind, really, to deal with the inexplicable and inevitable fact of death.
And it's interesting also that one of the first things that occur to people after a calamity is, who is to blame?
Right.
And this certainly happens.
Right.
How did this happen?
Yeah.
Start an investigation. Did the driver do it? What's the cause?
Yeah, there's
who
no,
did it?
In our secular age, there's no way we can deal with the causeless event without a lawsuit. And it's probably the only time, and certainly in his public career and in my life, where I ended up agreeing with Dan Quayle and in his recent criticism at the American Bar Association of attorneys, that there were indeed too many lawsuits. I might have said it differently, but it seems to me that our usual response to calamity, to disaster, is to go to court. Okay. As if that were going to cure or somehow eliminate or explain what happened. And, of course, it doesn't, and it leaves us even more frustrated and angry than we were to begin with.
Of course, I think there is also a public demand for a scapegoat.
Yeah, right.
And this is manifested in your novel by the demolition derby mm-hmm. toward the end. Mm-hmm. I hope this doesn't sound too far-fetched, but at first, when the school bus driver's station wagon, which he donated to the demolition derby, everybody was pounding on all the other cars were pounding on it, and there were mm-hmm. cheers. It was almost, at that point, like the lottery. Shirley Jackson's lottery,
yeah.
Like the school bus driver was being pilloried herself, stoned herself.
Yeah.
It turned around, of course. I don't want to give away the ending, but it turned around because she did she fought back.
Yeah, it's a more complicated event, really, that the town is dealing with than simply a. There's no simple victim. There's no simple crime here, and so the plot resolution has to reflect that complexity. So yeah, it does turn around. But you're right. I did want that to be seen as a kind of social ritual, and that was that had moral and even if you want spiritual resonance in the lives of the people who were participating in it. It was a coming together and a facing one another in a public arena in an organized and coherent way, dealing with the emotions that were evoked by the event.
Parenthetically, a couple of weeks ago here in New York, there was a subway accident that killed five people and injured something like 200 other people. The motorman apparently had been drinking and may have dozed at the in the motorman's cab or was just too drunk to operate correctly. He was initially charged with manslaughter, but then they decided they would charge him with murder. Mm-hmm. Now, when was the last time you ever heard of an accident resulting in a murder charge? Like if there's an airplane crash, they rarely charge. I've never heard of a pilot being charged with murder, even though he might have been completely responsible for the accident. What they're trying to do is, here again, we've got to blame somebody.
Yeah.
They're throwing the book at this guy much as they can, as if to say, well, we here in the administration of the city are doing something about this accident. We're going to charge the motorman with murder. It's not going to bring back anybody.
No, it isn't, and it isn't going to keep him from doing it again. That man, from what I've read about him, has had his life ruined by this event. He's not a murderer. He might have been a careless and stupid or addicted person. And that I'm sure is, you know, that might be true of him. But he's not. I wouldn't categorize him as a murderer, and just in terms of what he set out to do. But we don't believe in accidents. We're like Mitchell Stevens, the attorney in there, who's swimming north like a shark with his fin just above the snow. He says very explicitly, there are no accidents. There's always someone who was negligent. And negligence is the same thing as bad intentions. And therefore, we'll punish him. But why the person is being punished, sued, charged with murder, is really to affirm our deep desire and belief that there are no accidents. That's a terrifying notion, that there are accidents. If we accept that, good Lord, that our world might come undone.
You had lots of different jobs before you found your niche as a writer, didn't you? If I'm reading some of the biographical data they sent, what were some of the jobs you worked at?
I'm one of my generation of writers, those of us born, I suppose, in the early 40s or late 30s or whatever, we may be the last of the writers who had the old-fashioned kind of apprenticeship where the writer worked as a shoe salesman and a plumber and a truck driver. In my case, those were all true, or a window decorator in a department store, things like that, and wrote at night in a garret. And didn't end up going to a graduate writing program. Most of the writers my age, that's true of writers much a few years younger than I. That's generally not the case. But I had an old-fashioned apprenticeship in that sense. And out of necessity and circumstance, did work at a bunch of different jobs.
But didn't I read that you were the first in your family to go to college?
I did, yeah. I ended up being able to go to college when I was 24. I was married and had two children, and my mother-in-law very generously enabled me to go to college, and I ended up going to University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill in the middle 60s. And
did you study writing there?
No, I studied English literature, and you couldn't really study writing there, English literature, American history.
I think you can now. Aren't these writer workshops everywhere?
Pretty much. You can study there now. You can get a graduate degree in writing at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. You can now.
So what was your intention? You got your degree, right, from Chapel Hill.
Right.
Was your intention to go into teaching? Or what?
At that point, I was writing and publishing enough work around in magazines, and I'd done a little editing, and so I had a vita which allowed me to get a job teaching freshman English at the University of New Hampshire, which I did then, and that moved along, you know, so that I could build my both learn how to teach and build enough of a credibility so I could move along to teach other things, and then I was publishing more, and that managed to offset the disadvantage of not having a graduate degree or of any kind. And
isn't it interesting? It's kind of interesting to speculate on why people have the artistic temperament to, some people have an artistic temperament such as yourself to become a writer, and other people just don't. I mean, even successful people who go into, say, economics or Wall Street or law or so forth, there's really two types of people, the practical and the artistic. It just must be the luck of the draw, huh?
Sometimes it feels that way. I think that oftentimes you begin to write or paint or play jazz flute or whatever it is you do for reasons that are perhaps casual or incidental. You had a favorite uncle who did it, or you had a little talent at it and people praised you for it, and so you wanted some more praise or whatever. Purely accidental reasons, you get into it, and then you either like it and keep doing it, and pretty soon you're doing it for different reasons, or you back off and don't do it anymore. In my case, and I think in the case of most writers who continue to do it, you find that you like swimming in those turbulent waters, that it's more, you feel more alive then than in any other time than you do when you're safely on shore. It's more exciting and more engaging. You feel more alert to the nature of your own life and of others in a situation that most people would regard as chaotic and threatening, which is to say, you know, you're working alone in your room and you're working at something you cannot know is any good. You can't even know for sure whether it makes any sense while you're doing it. You're working blind in a sense, and yet what you're doing has to matter to you.
At risk. Certainly easier jobs and more lucrative ones.
Certainly more lucrative.
And well, writing is not known for its high pay scale.
No.
And jobs also where you have a greater degree of interaction. Of course, you teach.
Helps a lot. Yeah, and I don't have to teach for economic reasons anymore. So yet I continue to teach. I realized a few years ago that when I could quit teaching altogether if I wanted, that so I had to ask myself seriously the question, do you want to teach? And I found, yes, I really do. I want to teach, but I don't want to teach full-time. And I want to teach only under certain circumstances. I want to teach, you know, where I feel a easy companionability with my colleagues and students and so forth. I don't want to teach if I've got to get all caught up in academic politics or academic life. And I can do that, so I've continued to teach, but as I say, not necessarily anymore for economic reasons.
Well, I was talking to David Gates, who wrote a really terrific novel published a couple of months ago by Knopf called Jernigan.
Oh, yeah. I haven't read it yet, no.
Gates was married to Ann Beattie, who was his first wife. Mm-hmm. He reviews books and music for Newsweek. He says thank God he's got a job to go to, because sometimes he'll write and just sit for hours, nothing comes, and he just likes the idea of being able to go into an office where they have a computer, which he doesn't have, by the way, where he can talk to other people and to get away from that solitude.
Oh yeah, I think that's a very useful function for something like teaching. It is in my life. I like going into the office and knowing that I've got to do it, and I'm going to talk to a few people. I've got to be coherent today, and I've got to be lucid for a few hours. And it does bring you up, sort of blinking out of the darkness, and it's definitely useful and good for me.
Well, I guess you bump into Joyce Carol Oates down in Princeton.
Yeah, Joyce is there, and Toni Morrison is there. There are usually three or four other writers there, either, you know, filling in or visiting one thing or the other. I think Jeffrey Wolfe is there this semester visiting. And,
yeah, it's treating Jeffrey. After you remember his last book was about
it's about Princeton.
Princeton.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, wasn't too flattering.
How are they treating him? They hired him.
He did tell me that there was some flack. There were people who were quite offended, although this book was set in the 50s,
yeah,
and it dealt with the eating clubs,
right,
that were discriminatory toward,
right,
Jews.
Right.
And so it was not particularly flattering. The book was a wonderful book.
Yeah. And, but it was about them. I mean, and so it's about the family in a way.
And they have a certain jaundiced pride in it.
Yeah, right.
Have you ever picked up a literary magazine and not seen a Joyce Carol Oates story or poem in it?
She certainly does write a great deal. For which, in a way, I think she should be complimented rather than attacked, as she often is. She writes, to my mind, about as much as a Victorian male novelist, if you do page count. And nobody ever attacks Dickens or Trollope for having written so much. Well, Trollope they might, actually. But for what she does is write every day, and she writes with great discipline and knowledge. She is and conscious clarity about the process, and so she writes with a great deal more efficiency than most of us do. But what the amount of work she actually produces is not so astounding as or perplexing, I think, as you know, in the history of letters.
She always manages to place her stuff. I got lots of small magazines.
What's astounding to me is that so much of it is extraordinarily good.
Did you read her novel, Because It Is Bitter?
Yes.
I thought that was a beautiful
joke. That and You Must Remember This. This woman has by herself, I think, created, 52 or 3 years old, a body of work that I can't think of another American writer who has produced such a body of good work. You know, there are a few books here and a few books there that you say, oh, well, yes, but a real solid, substantial body of work. I admire her work enormously, not uniformly, but that wouldn't be possible.
Well, you are producing a significant body of work. You have about, 10, 12 books here, right? Two, three, four, five. Yeah, about 12, a dozen books to your credit now.
Right.
And they keep coming.
Well, I notice there's a kind of rhythm to the books. It takes me about 2 years between books, and there's a period of downtime where I just sort of stumble around not knowing who I am or what I do, and then click back in and then work for another year and a half or however long it takes before the book is done. But it takes me about 2 years between books, I think. I'm easily distracted. I have a large family and a great many animal appetites that I like to satisfy. So I can't work as efficiently as maybe Joyce does, or say John Updike does, or a few others. But
You obviously show a tremendous amount of discipline. There's no question about that. No matter how many animal appetites you may manifest. Well, The Sweet Hereafter, Russell Banks, it's a jewel of a book.
Oh, thanks.
And it's just a lovely book, and I loved it, and I congratulate you on it. And I really appreciate that you were able to take the time during this tour to talk to me, because I know you've had a very busy schedule.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hang on a second.